ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of the Politics Now podcast. And navigating what our rapidly changing world means can be tricky.
There's an argument that there's still a lot of uncertainty, isn't there, around the drivers of the global energy market?
That's why I'm joined by the sharpest political minds at the ABC to break down what each development means for Australia and how the government is positioning.
The Prime Minister's keeping his options open. He can increase that reduction or he can take it away altogether and go back to the system that where it was before the war started.
That's Politics Now with me, Patricia Carvelis. Find it on ABC Listen.
Are we heading for a private credit crunch? Financial regulator ASIC has raised concerns that we could be, putting Australians on alert about their super funds and the property market investing in dark pools of cash. Meanwhile, KPMG issues fines to partners and staff involved in its audit scandal, but that's nothing on ASIC. The financial regulator has raked in hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, more than four times the previous year's take, with a new stance on enforcement paying dividends. What to make of this record-breaking number? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Daniel Ziffer.
And I'm ABC News Business Editor Michael Yander.
So Mike, a few issues to do with regulator ASIC today. First of all, what's that ticking sound? It's private credit. Now, the regulator is waving the flag about what's been a massively expanding field of finance. The RBA and other central banks concerned as well. What's happening in private credit?
Yeah, so private credit is basically lending that's done outside of the banking system. So by hedge funds or private equity funds, or some of these funds are listed. You can buy shares in them on publicly listed markets to buy a stake in these debts that they're lending to big corporates and smaller corporates as well. All kinds of lending going through this. What has the regulators really concerned is that a lot of this private credit is really a black hole. They regulate banks. Banks are required to provide regular disclosures to the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority in Australia and their equivalents overseas about the type of loans they're making. And if any of those loans start going bad, they're required to update the regulators and the market about that as well. The difference is a lot of these private credit loans are with private funds and they have little or no disclosure obligations. So we're talking about, at a minimum in the US, $1.5 trillion in private credit that's now outstanding. Some estimates put the global private credit market at up to $3 trillion. And in Australia, it's estimated that this sector of the market is about a quarter of $1 trillion, $250 billion. But we don't know for sure because they have no disclosure obligations. So all of these are guesstimates, and that's what has regulators worried. If these loans start turning bad, we won't know for a long time until it gets really bad.
So there's a great report about this morning on the ABC website from our colleague David Taylor. It has even more detail. We really do get a very insightful look in due to our financial institutions, authorised deposit-taking institutions, having to report to APRA. We get to find out how many loans they've got, how big they are. We get this information. It really is that much of a pit where the regulators in particular, APRA, ASIC and others, they just don't have that level of insight to private capital.
That's right. And the thing that's really worrying ASIC, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, who David interviewed for his excellent piece that you can find on the website, Commissioner Simone Constant is really worried because basically every working Australian and most retired Australians have a stake in private credit, even though they don't realise it, because pretty much every superannuation fund, big and many of the smaller ones as well, have some investment in the private credit sector because it has grown so much over the past 15 or 20 years. I read a really interesting academic paper about private credit by some law academics from the US, and they were making the point that private credit's pretty much always been around. It's been around for a very long time. It's just expanded exponentially, roughly tenfold, both in Australia and in the US since the global financial crisis, because, of course, banks made a lot of dodgy housing loans that led to the global financial crisis, starting in the US with the subprime mortgages, and regulators really cracked down on banks and what they could lend to and how much capital they had to support those loans, made bank lending less flexible and less competitive. And this opened up a whole new space where if I'm a rapidly expanding corporation and I need to raise money quickly, well, maybe a bank is no longer the cheapest and easiest place to get the money. So a lot of them are going to private credit.
There was a push by the previous federal government to loosen responsible lending laws. We had some of our big four bank CEOs basically saying that responsible lending laws made it almost impossible to lend to anyone in an entrepreneurial sense. You know, you had to have property behind it. You're essentially already lending to people who already had money. What this has led to is an expansion in these private credit firms, which are now advertising on the back of football jumpers. This is not, you know, dodgy alleyway, brown paper bags full of cash stuff. You know, these are big companies that are making these investments. I guess what has the regulator worried is that without that insight, with many of them very geared into property, if we do have a substantial fall in property values, there's going to be some real gaps.
Yeah, as David's article notes, around half the private credit in Australia, unlike the US where a lot of this private credit's been going into software companies, and that's the big concern over there. A lot of the funds that have been investing in software businesses because of the downturn, AI-driven downturn in software, they're the ones where investors are trying to take money out. And some of those big funds, including Apollo, Blue Owl and others, have limited what's called redemptions, that is how much money investors can take out in any quarter from the fund to try and stop a run on these funds. In Australia, though, about half of the money going to private credit is going into property development. Not really a surprise in this country where everything either goes into mining or property. As you say, Dan, the concern here is we're starting to see a housing downturn. And, you know, if some of those developments don't work out and there are losses, it could be these end investors, some of which are superannuation funds that wear it. And again, it's back to the future. Back when banking was even more regulated back in the 1980s, you had a lot of investment funds issuing things called debentures, where you could get a higher interest rate investing in essentially private credit. And guess what? In the late 80s, during high interest rates and during the market crash, heaps of them blew up and lots of people, including my grandparents, lost money in those kind of investments, and ASIC is worried that we might see history repeat.
We'll get back to property, but there's more interesting numbers from ASIC, who reportedly brought in a record $830 million during the last financial year. Now, the federal budget deficit is going to be about $31.5 billion, so we're not going to have a fine lead return to prosperity, but it's quite a start here. What's changed?
Yeah, I guess you could call it the bad boy tax, and it is raising quite a bit of money. It is reflecting ASIC's focus on enforcement. It is also reflecting some pretty big financial collapses and misdemeanors that we've seen over the past couple of years that have resulted in these penalties last financial year. I think we saw a foreign exchange broker pinged for $300 million. So that's, roughly speaking, more, you know, almost 40% of the total just in that. ANZ also copped a big penalty as well. On the other side of the ledger, ASIC's also got back something like $650 million or thereabouts for retail investors through out-of-court settlements or, you know, arrangements with companies, and most notably Shield and First Guardian. You had institutions such as Macquarie, which was the superannuation trustee for a large proportion of those investors, agreeing to pay them back in full, which was about a $321 million whack of compensation. So a lot of money going to the government coffers in penalties, and also some money going back to consumers.
This money goes into the pit of consolidated revenue and some of it back to consumers, as you noted. It's been a long time complaint from ASIC that they don't have the resources required to do their job, even though they're bringing in huge sums of money. Do you think that's a part of that is what has changed under the previous chair, Joe Longo, who's stepped aside now for Sarah Court, and that potentially this kind of record-breaking year we've had sets the tone for the years ahead?
Yeah, well, I think when you look at it, ASIC really, it's been a bit of a cash cow for the government, as you point out, Dan, because it's not just the penalties that it gets. It's been the long-standing guardian of the business register, and companies have to pay annual fees to keep their company registration with the regulator. And again, it's not like ASIC gets to keep the cash. It puts that cash back into consolidated revenue, and then it gets a funding allocation in the budget, and the funding it gets is not equivalent to what it raises for the government. It's a profit-making centre for the government. And when you see in ASIC's media release, they say they launched more than 250 investigations over the past financial year. There are millions of companies in Australia. There are thousands doing the wrong thing, and ASIC only investigated 250 of them or thereabouts. They only got 25 criminal convictions for white-collar crime, resulting in 11 people going to jail over a whole financial year. Now, those are tiny numbers when you consider the scale of corporate and investment activity in Australia and the scale of wrongdoing that we've seen exposed even just in the media. And we know very well the media is not well resourced to investigate these things. So, you know, there is a real argument here, given how much money ASIC is bringing in, that it needs more resources to, you know, investigate the corporate wrongdoing that's out there. A recent Senate inquiry found that ASIC is only investigating a tiny fraction, single-digit percentages, of the reports that come into it from insolvency practitioners. So this is cases where companies have collapsed, been put into administration or receivership, and the person doing the receivership has said to ASIC, "We think there's a problem here, and we think there are people who've broken the Corporations Act," which ASIC is in charge of regulating, and they haven't investigated in the vast majority of those cases. And it's simply an issue of resourcing.
During the Banking Royal Commission, the then head of ASIC was James Shipton. He recalled how he had been working in Hong Kong at the similar regulator in a similar sized market. And the regulator was three times the size of ASIC. Now, I think ASIC has increased slightly since that time, but certainly not to that level of scale where not providing the scrutiny because the cattle aren't there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard to imagine ASIC being too large to fulfil the statutory obligations it has under the Corporations Act. I mean, many a year ago, I did a law degree. Corporations law, I must confess, was not one of my best subjects. It is a massive piece of legislation. I still have it as a stand on which my laptop screen sits in the office, because it's so thick, it's quite a useful stand. And, you know, just the complexity of the rules around it, the resources with which some of the larger entities that ASIC has to come up against when they do the wrong thing, the resources they can throw at the legal battles are immense. So it is impossible to fathom a corporate regulator that is over-resourced, and ASIC certainly isn't it.
Well, also on the to-do list for the regulator is looming legislative changes that will give them more oversight of the big four consulting firms. They're in the frame because of scandal around KPMG's use of confidential audit information. Today reported that KPMG taking action with fines of its own against a group of internal staff and partners after the third part of this scandal, probably the most understandable one, which is where some staff took information from the confidential audit of telecommunications company Optus and use that to try and win the vastly more lucrative contract to audit Telstra. What's happening?
So we're seeing internal penalties of up to $180,000 for some staff reported. We're seeing first and final warnings for other staff, reduced performance ratings and, career limiting penalties, if you like, Dan, but you got to ask, is it really enough given the scale of the wrongdoing that's alleged? Look, just to put it in context, from a lot of the evidence we've seen, you know, once you make partner at one of these big consulting firms, it seems like many of them are pulling in the high hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in pay. So, you know, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, that kind of range for the senior partners. So, you know, a fine of $180,000 sounds like a lot. it would wipe out my pay packet for the year. But for many of these people, it's you know, it's annoying, but they're saving $30,000 or $40,000 a year in tax from the trust structures that they've used in the past that are now being cracked down on. So that gives you some context around what $180,000 might mean for the kind of people involved.
Well, Mike, it's Monday, which means auction clearance rates are in and preliminary numbers are at 50%. This is the ninth week of low figures, the longest sustained slump since 2018. Now, the team's been tracking this downturn in numbers on the pod. What's new this week?
Look, not as much as some of the headlines would suggest, but because we've seen consistently low clearance rates hovering really for the final clearance rate, we're likely to see it come in the mid-40s again because it's usually about 5 or 6 percentage points below the preliminary clearance rate because, surprise, surprise, real estate agents are much keener to tell the property data firms about the houses they've sold rather than the ones they didn't. And we've seen that rate consistently over the past couple of months. But this consistency is a bit of a new story because we're now seeing consistently the lowest clearance rates that we've seen since the last major ongoing downturn we had back in late 2017 through to the beginning of 2019. So really that 2018 downturn driven by tighter lending rules from the banking regulator, that was, you know, we saw property prices in Sydney fall by roughly double digits and falls in other major cities as well. It's actually when I bought my house, Dan. So thank you, banking regulator, for making the market go down so I could actually afford a place to live in, which is the flip side of these things, you know.
It is, but there's some data from Ray White that suggests that this situation might continue. What have we learned about open homes?
Yeah, so it's not surprising that we're seeing less than 50% of homes sell at auction because we're seeing far fewer people come through for open home inspections. So at the start of the year, we were seeing, according to the Ray White data, which looks at about 13,000 open homes, so a lot weekly, they were seeing about 3.6 people come through per open home nationally. That's fallen to 2.1, so down more than 40%. Of course, if there are fewer people interested in buying, then when you get to the auction, if it's going to auction, there are fewer people likely to be bidding. Therefore, less competition, lower prices, and more auctions that fail because they don't meet seller expectations.
There is another element, of course, that when prices are bad, people who don't have to sell don't. And this reduces the amount of supply, and there's still a lot of people chasing fewer properties. So prices then tend to rise, people get confident to sell, and the cycle begins again. So it will be interesting in all these individual markets because people aren't generally looking to buy a house randomly in somewhere in Australia. They're looking for a very specific place where they already are or where they want to move to. I guess we'll see what happens with this slump. But at the moment, very low interest, and it's hard to see with all the conjecture about future interest rate direction that there's going to be any kind of hot interest anytime soon.
Yeah, well, you're dead right, Dan. Whichever property analyst you speak to, that is generally how property cycles go in Australia. I mean, you can sometimes have regulatory interventions that also short-circuit things. So that 2018 downturn we were talking about, that was sparked by the banking regulator. And then on the surprise return of the Morrison government in 2019 with Josh Frydenberg as treasurer, there were discussions with the RBA and APRA. And sure enough, shortly after the government was re-elected, APRA slightly softened those lending restrictions and the Reserve Bank cut interest rates. And what do you know, the property downturn ended and prices started rising again, even before we then got to COVID, of course, which was another dip. But then the Reserve Bank cut interest rates again and prices took off like crazy, especially with the home builder stimulus the government put in. So you can get these regulatory things that spark the market. And I think we've seen that with rate rises this year that sparked the downturn. When you look at the open home graph, it's really interesting. Most of the decline in interest happened before the budget. And Ray White's Nerida Conisby notes this in that report. But there was another little leg down post-budget as well, which has taken us to this level of about 2.1 people coming per open home. And as you say, the cycle usually turns when you get prices falling enough that sellers go, you know what, I don't really need to sell right now. I'm going to sit out and wait and see where this lands. You also sometimes get buyers going, you know what, I don't want to buy into a falling market because things might get cheaper. The market generally drops off in activity, eventually to the point where there are enough people who need to buy and want to buy now that prices start stabilizing, sellers get more confidence, as you say, Dan, and the market starts ticking up again. We are probably closer to that part of the cycle in cities like Sydney, Melbourne, which have consistently been down at 2 people per inspection and have seen more modest falls in the market, like bigger price falls already, but they're not going down as steeply as somewhere like Brisbane, which was booming last year, has seen people looking at open homes drop from nearly 5 per inspection down to 2. So a huge drop off in interest there. And it's just on the start of its downward price cycle. And we're starting to see maybe cities like Adelaide and Perth, which again have been super hot, they're at that point in the cycle where they've maybe reached the peak and are now starting to flip down, because we saw a big drop off in people looking at open homes in Perth. There's still 3 people per average open home, which is the most in the country, but that is down from 5.7 last year. So a big cooling compared to the boom we had.
Very expensive in Australia to buy your own mine. So I confidently predict people still keep attempting to buy houses.
Yeah, unless your name's Gina.
Yeah.
Still very expensive, but you've got the money.
That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send us in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. That's ABC Business Daily, all one word, at abc.net.au. Mike, lovely to chat. Catch you later.
Always a lot of fun, Dan. See ya.